We start out every Friday with the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week. And this week, my experts choosing the most important federal news stories of the week are Tim Hext of Agilex. Tim, it's great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Chief Technology Officer there, and Vice President of ICF International, Jeff Neal, is here. It's good to see you as always, my friend.
Good to be here.
You were just here. You were just on the show on Tuesday.
I think so.
And it is great to have you back. The three most important federal news stories of the week, as you gentlemen have selected them, will be posted later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com. And we start where we always do with...
Number three!
Tim, your choice for the third most important federal news story of the week is from Wired. Not a typical source, but this headline is really wild. This 6 foot, 330-pound robot may one day save your life. What should we all know about this story? Why is this such a big deal to you, Tim?
Well, my stories this week are not as much federal as I think have impact in what we're trying to do in the federal government, as particularly related to the application of technology. And what interested me in this was not so much the robot, although that's cool. You know, how can you not be excited by the actually just the picture of the guy? But the way DARPA is using it as a platform to get teams to innovate. And so they're basically using it as a common platform. It has no brain. It's got advanced eyesight, and it can walk, and it's strong, and it's got all kinds of sensors, but it has no brain.
So it's qualified to be a radio host then. It's
exactly, yes. And the point is they're creating a competition where university teams will use this open platform, this common platform to learn to develop software for it. And I'm a fan of that kind of thinking when we solve technology problems. All of these teams could not have gotten together this kind of equipment, but they can innovate on the software development by leveraging this common platform. And I just think that's the right way to go about incenting innovation. So I like that.
This is a really cool thing. I agree with what you say about what this means and approaches, ways to take innovative approaches. But the picture's just really cool.
Picture is cool.
You got to admit, this is a pretty neat looking deal.
That's right. And DARPA was in the news a bit this week and trying to rebuild the focus on core research that has always been, I think, a priority in the way I think something that makes government great is the opportunity to do that kind of investment. So I like to see stories like this one that are in the mainstream and Wired with a cool piece of technology, but DARPA also being at the core of ensuring that government's investing in the right kind of platform to innovate.
I know budgets are the way they are, and that's the reality moving forward. But it seems to me that with some of the innovations we've seen out of DARPA in the past 10, 15, 20 years, that there's got to be some room somewhere in a budget to encourage this kind of innovation, not just at the Pentagon and not just in the Energy Department with ARPA-E. There have to be other places where this would be applicable and where you could show maybe not a return on investment on every single individual project, but on the program overall.
Well, yeah. I mean, it used to be that government was the place that people came to do hard science. And it's the place where young people out of college wanted to go work because that's where it was happening. And now that's not true. They want to go into the commercial space because that's where the real research is. And but government has the opportunity to invest in things for which there is no incentive in the commercial world. And that's why we have so many, you know, innovations today. And so as DARPA, as one of the key places where that happens, and you're right, it happens in other places in government, gets a focus on making sure that they are incenting people to want to come solve government challenges. This is not just about making a robot that can do your laundry. Clearly, this is intended to be a piece of equipment that can go pull people from a failed nuclear power plant or whatever, you know, whatever kind of hazardous environment. But the innovation here, to me, is less in the robot and more in the collaborative team gaming simulation in order to use it as a platform for development.
Jeff, Tim, speaking your language, it sounds like. This is how many times have you and I had this conversation?
Quite a few.
Yeah. The third most important federal news story of the week is selected by Tim Hex. It's from Wired. The headline, this 6 foot, 330-pound robot may one day save your life. Jeff, your third most important federal news story of the week is from MarketWatch. The headline is, President Obama says we underestimated complexities in creating the health site. And I have to confess, I saw the headline on the story and I said, you think? But but to be fair, you know, this is something nobody's ever tried before. However, it does seem that the deeper they get into this, the deeper they get into this.
You know what was really funny on this one, Francis, is first of all, it's an interesting news week when this would be the third most important story of the week. The one of the things I've run into in my years in government is this idea with software development projects that failure occurs often. A third of them, mm-hmm. I've heard numbers as high as a third of them, just fail and nobody gets anything out of their investment. If you or I went out to buy a car and we knew that a third of the time when we bought a car, it would just blow up and we'd lose every dollar we spent on it, we would be up in arms. We would not accept that. And although I tend to agree with a fair amount of what our president says, on this particular one, I honestly think he didn't go far enough. You know, he said that this was they underestimated the complexities, and he said this was a problem with the government procurement process. And actually, although I do think the government procurement process doesn't serve the government very well, I don't think it serves industry very well, I don't think this was a procurement problem. This was a program management problem. And what causes these failures in large system development or deployment more often than not is a lack of executive attention and a lack of good program management. And so this one is almost like the poster child for program management and why program management is absolutely essential if you're going to deploy something like this. It doesn't just happen. And if you don't have good program management, more often than not, you'll fail. And this one, I'm hoping, doesn't turn into a failure. I'm hoping they're able to pull it out and people will be able to sign up for health insurance. It's an important system, but it's a program management problem.
I think you're exactly right. And one thing that surprised me in the House Oversight Committee hearing this week was that maybe it was the end of last week. Congressman Issa asked. It was Stephen Van Roekel and Todd Park, Tony Trinkle, and maybe Tony wasn't there. Henry Chow from CMS was there. And nobody really would admit, nobody would say I had the final say on anything. And that was my indication that what you're saying is exactly right, because nobody seemed to be in charge, and that was the cohort of people that you would think somebody would be able to say, I had the final sign-off on stuff, and it's my responsibility.
You know, 10 years ago, I worked for the Defense Logistics Agency for a long time, and we deployed a new business system that we used to run the core business of the agency. So we were really kind of betting the agency on this system. It ended up costing $1 billion. And the vice director of the agency at the time was a real visionary, I believe. And he called all the senior civilians together. He said, look, this thing is not going to be rolled out on my watch or my relief's watch or his or her watch. But you folks are going to be here. And so he put together a process where the most senior civilian leadership of the agency spent one day every 2 weeks all day long going over this project. And he said, you know, people are going to tell you it's not worth the time. It's not worth, you know, you spending a week out of every 2 weeks working on it. It's a $1 billion project, and it's the future of the agency. And so you've got to have that kind of leadership attention all the way through the process. And somebody needs to be in charge.
Tim, it strikes me, though, that we've seen enough of these now that although at that point that was visionary, it seems to me it shouldn't be visionary anymore. That should be SOP in a program of this size, of this importance to the administration.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a classic example. I couldn't agree with you more about the pointing the fault at the procurement process, while in fact the procurement process is flawed in many ways. It sort of says, oh, of course, you know, we procured the wrong contractor, or we bought the wrong software, rather than pointing at the idea that we we implemented it, we were responsible for building it. The problem is that the responsibilities have become so distributed in these big complex programs that those folks that you described that could not stand up and say it was me, we're right.
Yeah.
There's no one person, and they aren't close enough
yes.
to it. And having somebody who's personally committed to watching it day in and day out, we see it all the time. The programs that succeed have that relentless commitment from the business and technology and support leadership day in and day out, week in and week out. And the ones that say, we'll see the first demo of your system in 18 months and hold your breath until then, those fail.
Yeah, to be fair, I didn't want to suggest that I thought somebody should have taken responsibility who didn't, but because your point is exactly right. None of those people were it.
Right.
And that's the flaw in the process. Jeff Neal's third most important federal news story of the week is from MarketWatch. The headline is President Obama says we underestimated complexities in creating HealthSight. All of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown are posted at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later today. The second most important stories of the week from Jeff Neal and Tim Hext when we come back on the Federal News Countdown. Welcome back to In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Tim Hext of AgileX and Jeff Neal of ICF International. We're up to the second most important federal news story of the week, Jeff, according to Jeff Neal, is from the Washington Post. The headline is Senate's filibuster rule change should help Obama achieve key second-term priorities. And this Washington Post story details this thing that people are calling the nuclear option. I wonder if it's something to get quite that up in arms about. But I certainly do understand the gravity here, and I wonder if the Senate, especially the Democratic Senate, is willing to trade some short-term gain for some long-term pain, Jeff.
This was kind of an interesting one because I think it can have a very far-reaching effect. The filibuster has been abused in the last 5 years, and it's pretty obvious when you look at the numbers that half of the appointments that have been filibustered in the history of the country have been filibustered since President Obama was elected. What's interesting, though, is what's going to happen as a result. I mean, I've heard people say that they think actually a lot of the moderates in the Senate are going to be relieved, particularly moderate Republicans, assuming there are some left, are going to be relieved because now they won't have to support filibusters on things just to stay in the good graces of the people who donate money and who vote in primaries. But I think the more far-reaching impact is going to be on two things. One is on appointments to the executive branch. There have been a fair number of executive branch appointments that have been filibustered in the last few years, and some of them don't get to the point of a filibuster, that the filibuster is threatened, and then the nomination never goes forward. And in many cases, you find people that I mean, I know people who have said, no, I am not going to agree to be considered for a presidential appointment because I am not going to go through that confirmation process and be put in limbo, put my life in limbo for a year while I go through it. So I think you're going to see more people willing to be considered for Senate-confirmed presidential appointments. You're going to see people appointing folks who are maybe a little more strident in their views. If, for example, if you look at what happened with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, it was very clear a lot of people wanted Elizabeth Warren. She was going to get filibustered, and so her name was never put forward. Now, there's some other folks who say the administration would have never nominated her anyway, but you may find that people that you're looking now at a lot of folks who are kind of middle of the road who won't be too offensive. If you don't have to worry about a filibuster, you may find the administration willing to go for nominees who are much more in line with their views and not just the people that they can get through a confirmation process. The other thing that's going to be really important about this is there are about 90 federal judgeships that are vacant right now. And without a filibuster threat on judges, you could see a really substantial reshaping of the judiciary over the next 3 years that the president is in office. If you look at those 90, he probably isn't going to fill all of those, but if you look at those 90 and then the vacancies that occur, you'll see a very large swing toward Obama-appointed judges over the next 3 years. That has a huge impact. It has an impact on how federal regulations are viewed by the courts. It has an impact on how privacy issues are viewed, how civil rights issues are viewed. Virtually everything you can think of that touches the American people, and in particular the American government, could be affected by that change in judges. So this, to me, is a huge story.
What do you see when you look at this, Tim? I mean, there are a lot of folks that I think will look at this and say, despite the terrifically eloquent case that Jeff just made for the importance of this, this doesn't really affect my life. This doesn't make a big difference.
Well, we spend every day of our job working in government to help them solve problems. And increasingly, the leadership positions in those organizations are empty.
Mm-hmm.
People are in acting positions, and they're great. Maybe they should be the person or not. But the sense of uncertainty that this breeds throughout government organizations, that they're out just waiting to see who will be in, let's not act because somebody is going to be in charge and we won't know what he or she wants, so let's wait. There is a paralysis that bleeds through the system as a result of this, and stuff doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you, the person is on the left or right or young or old or competent or it's the unknowing that causes things to wait. So if this lights a fire under that and allows many of those positions to get filled more rapidly, I think it has the opportunity to grease the skids of action inside government, which is good.
The second most important federal news story of the week, selected by Jeff Neal, is from the Washington Post. Senate's filibuster rule change should help Obama achieve key second-term priorities. Tim, your second most important story of the week is from the Harvard Business Review, another publication not oft-cited on the federal news countdown. But this is an interesting take on management. The headline is How Google Sold Its Engineers on Management. And this is a company that most people think of as very horizontal, mm-hmm. and yet there are some ideas about how they're rethinking that and have rethought that, and you see something here that might apply to our friends on the government side.
Yeah, so a couple things struck me about this. First, I've recently read this book called The Circle. I don't know if you've seen this book, but
no.
It's a sci-fi apocalyptic. Don't worry about it.
Is it a nerd book, Tim?
It is, but think of it as taking social media to the extreme until we all work for one big mega corporation. So, but anyway, what struck me about that was, and so maybe I'm hypersensitive to these things, but there are a couple things in this. One, the way Google addressed this problem by measuring everything. They did what Google does.
Mm-hmm.
They gathered data and they analyzed it and they measured it and they have surveys of their people and surveys of their managers and they surveyed the hell out of all of it. And in some ways, it makes what should be a personal thing so impersonal, a personal thing about the relationship between good managers and good employees and so on. So in some ways, it was a really telling example of the way we're viewing how we architect our lives through the application of data and analysis, which at my heart I love, but also it feels a little cold in mm-hmm. this case. However, that having been said, the other thing that struck me most about this, we were talking about in the prior stories about some of the failures of government programs. One of the things we focus on a lot is agile software development, and we're seeing that everybody looks for the magic bullet of how to run a program. Oh, we used to do it that way. Now we're going to do it this way. And that'll fix everything, right? Rather than just the common sense of how to do things. And one of the tenets of Agile is that teams are self-managing. And one of the things we're seeing a lot is that folks say, oh, you got to let the developers manage themselves. You got to let them decide what we'll work on next and so on. And that's kind of the Google way to, like, if you think about, that's the way engineers like to mm-hmm. think. If engineers could design a management process, it would involve no managers, right? And so the heart of this story is really that Google had to convince its engineering and culture that management matters. And we're seeing this every day in our government programs as the pendulum has swung from management heavy to, oh, well, let's try the alternate, very hip approach of no management and let everybody, let the teams decide what they should work on. We're seeing that that end of the pendulum isn't right either.
Mm-hmm.
Good management matters. Teams and people need to be led. They need to be inspired. They need to be measured. They need to be rewarded. They need to be incented. Now, too much management is not effective. I like that they talk about the data analysis in guiding the actions and activities that they use to improve management, not just hit it with a stick or give it a carrot. You know, they were really trying to have action-oriented improvements. So this story had a lot in it, I thought, that can act as guideposts for, A, how we view evolving the way we lead people, but also in this world of Agile with big complex programs and lots of diverse personalities, how important it's going to remain, maybe not to have a lot of management, but to have quality management.
What lessons can we pull out of this, Jeff, and either copy or apply in one form or another inside government that maybe the agencies aren't leveraging right now?
Well, one of the things I've heard in the past that probably Google learned is whatever one programmer can do in a month, three programmers can do in 3 months. And so I think they probably learned that management is important. The thing that I took out of that was most interesting is the use of data. I've been an advocate for a long time for data-driven management. That doesn't mean you manage solely by the numbers. People are people, and you have to account for that human variation. But there is so much information, particularly in the government, where there are so many systems, where there is so much information stored. There's so much information available to people that they don't use. And it's amazing what you can learn when you start looking at the information you already have. And you can start making decisions based on facts, not based on just on your opinion. And there is a tendency a lot of times in management to manage based on the personal opinions of the leader. And that can get you into a lot of trouble. I have seen organizations break themselves because they start off down a path because they believe something was true, but they didn't really check it out.
Mm-hmm.
And once they got real data in their hands, they learned that it wasn't true. Great example, at DLA, we had a field activity that had a lot of problems with employee surveys coming back really bad. They thought the problem was that their minority employees were not as happy as their majority employees, and so they should have more upward mobility programs. When they started slicing and dicing the data, what we discovered actually was that their minority employees had a much better attitude about the workplace and about the work they did and about the people they worked for. And the folks who were least happy were middle-aged white guys. If they had done what they had in mind, which was an upward mobility program, they would have just ticked off the middle-aged white guys even more. So having some data actually helped them to shape a response that could make a difference in their workplace, not just the one that they plucked out of thin air.
The second most important story of the week on the countdown is from Tim Hext, is from the Harvard Business Review, how Google sold its engineers on management, and there are a lot of lessons to learn in this piece. It'll be linked up later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The most important stories of the week, as selected by Jeff Neal and by Tim Hext, when we come back on this week's Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Tim Hext of AgileX and by Jeff Neal of ICF International. And we're up to
number one.
And Tim, your most important federal news story of the week is from the MIT Technology Review. You're 3 for 3 now on publications that do not get cited very often on the Federal News Countdown.
I'm doing my best.
This is headlined, "The Decline of Wikipedia." And this is a really fascinating argument for that service. What's the implication here for what you're seeing? All of the stories that you've referenced have have had some connection to data and its use. Mm-hmm. Is that a theme you were going for, or is this coincidental?
Well, I would say that's part of my DNA, is everything I think about all the time is relates to data and its use. And what struck me about this is we seem to have an inevitability in the way we think about some of these services going on, whether it's Wikipedia or Facebook or Google, that they will always be there, always be getting bigger, always be getting better. And this kind of talks about a chink in the armor in that. And Wikipedia's struggling to, as the human factors get involved and bureaucracies form and power plays ensue and opinions reign, they're struggling to maintain an environment where new ideas can come and participate. And so the main point here is that their number of editors they have has diminished because it's not welcoming to new. There's a interesting reference that the old newspaper reporter wouldn't go out and cover the fire. They'd get the cub reporter to go out and do that. And this is not an environment that facilitates new people coming in because they're kind of so quickly squashed by the editorial oppression maybe that is starting to build. And so the inevitability kind of the pervasiveness that we see in Wikipedia is not so. And they talk a little bit about some of the things they're going to try and do to fix it. But nobody can wield with a strong hand to just change Wikipedia. It's really a community thing. Mm-hmm. And so how do you control community things when the community is in charge and the community is taking it down a dangerous path? And so I just found these kinds of issues important when we think about the curation of information.
Jeff, this is fascinating to me because this is the other side of crowdsourcing. Mm-hmm. And it's the thing that people forget about crowdsourcing, which is you can only source the crowd that shows up.
Right.
You don't automatically have access to every single one of the 325 million or whatever Americans that are out there or the 6 billion people on planet Earth or whatever. You only get who wants to come.
Yeah, people have to want to participate. They have to want to actually share factual information. Wikipedia has been the victim of some interesting incidents over the years. I remember watching Stephen Colbert on the Colbert Report talking about wikiality and going on Wikipedia and changing things on the air. and you'll notice sometimes that you'll if you use Wikipedia, and I find Wikipedia fascinating, you can go in there and you can tell with public figures where the post that's there has been heavily influenced by people who work for them. Because if you go to their websites, you'll see things that they say, and then you see the exact same language on Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. So people are using Wikipedia sometimes to enhance their own reality, which is kind of a nice idea, I guess, if you can get away with it. But it does kind of bring into question the validity of the information you find on Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to me, the whole wiki concept is something we leverage outside of Wikipedia. Uh-huh. This idea that the community comes together to maintain the content, and in general, when the community is large enough, it's self-policing. Uh-huh. But this community has become too large, mm-hmm. and so it cannot just be purely self-policing. It needs some police, and the hoaxy kind of stuff you referenced, they had to put some controls in to prevent that to survive. But now those become a little bit oppressive, and then bureaucracies form, and then it slips down a slope that was not part of the original design. So I find that interesting.
The part of this that jumped out at me is right at the beginning. Among the significant problems that aren't getting resolved is the site's skewed coverage. Its entries on Pokemon and female porn stars are comprehensive, but its pages on female novelists or places in sub-Saharan Africa are sketchy. Of the 1,000 articles that the project's own volunteers have tagged as forming the core of a good encyclopedia, most don't earn even Wikipedia's own middle-ranking quality scores. And that kind of was where the concept of you can only rely on who shows up came from. And it's the same concept, I guess, in hiring, as you and I have talked about before. You can only hire from the people that you can attract. Yeah, the people who apply. You can't just go out and corral people off the street and say, you'd probably be a good candidate. You take this job.
You find this in hiring processes. You find it in employee surveys. You know, the only people you end up getting a response from are the people who show up and want to respond. If you get an employee survey response rate of 60 or 70%, you did incredibly well. That means a third or more of your employees didn't tell you what they thought, and you really don't know what they think. So a lot of things like this are probably slightly skewed by who is showing up and who is responding. I do wonder with Wikipedia, too, if part of the problem now might be that the ability to crowdsource information has become so common that maybe Wikipedia doesn't need to serve in the role that it thought it would serve, that people thought it would serve when they started.
Well, this article actually begins to reference that people are now spending their time consolidating information mm-hmm. in the social media space mm-hmm. and putting what they know into right. Facebook. But there it's more about aggregating mm-hmm. the total commentary rather than curating mm-hmm. it. And it does need some editorial depth for it to be right. useful. The real challenge is there. You don't have the experts in there. And Facebook certainly doesn't have right. the experts curating the dialogue. And I'd rather see, you talked about, I don't know, Stephen Colbert's page or noteworthy people. I'd rather see them in a different venue. Like, they should have a public Facebook page where they can publicize mm-hmm. what they want about themselves. And if we could get sources like Wikipedia to have it be more open environment for incenting experts who can really curate the information, would be, I think, a better overall result.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Tim Hext of AgileX, is the decline of Wikipedia. It's from the MIT Technology Review. It's a fascinating piece, and you can find it linked later at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We'll wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown in a moment with Jeff Neal's choice for the most important federal news story of the week. That's next on In-Depth with Francis Rose. We're back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. And we're at the top of the list on this week's Federal News Countdown as far as Jeff Neal is concerned. And you cheated this week.
I know.
You cheated, and it's not fair. And it's you're hiding your face, which I think is terrific. Your choice for the most important federal news story of this week is not actually a news story. It is the text of President Kennedy's State of the Union Address, January 30th, 1961, as we observe today the 50th anniversary of his assassination in Dallas, and all kinds of observances and remembrances and so on today, as there should be. Why is this particular speech and the text therein so important on a day like today, do you think, Jeff?
Well, I felt like I had to talk about President Kennedy. It's November 22nd. It was 50 years ago today. All of us who were alive back then remember where we were, what was going on when the president was killed. And I didn't give you a news story because there are probably 10,000 news stories we could find in the next 5 minutes about President Kennedy and his assassination. People are talking a lot about the president. They're talking about the space program. They're talking about everything that happened during his administration. But very few people talk about his commitment to public service as a noble undertaking. And in his first State of the Union address, 10 days into being president, he said, "Let every public servant know, whether his post is high or low, that a man's rank and reputation in this administration will be determined by the size of the job he does and not by the size of his staff, his office, or his budget. Let it be clear that this administration recognizes the value of dissent and daring, that we greet healthy controversy as the hallmark of healthy change. Let the public service be a proud and lively career, and let every man and woman who works in any area of our national government, in any branch, at any level, be able to say with pride and with honor in future years, I serve the United States government in that hour of our nation's need." That's a part of the story that you don't hear as much. And we were talking earlier about how the federal government used to be where people went to do good science, because there were so many things that you could do that don't have a commercial application. one of the reasons that a lot of people got interested in science was the space program that, that President Kennedy was so vocal in supporting when he said, we choose to go to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And you can probably tell that I sort of have a high regard for President Kennedy.
Yeah, I noticed.
But he wanted people to understand that serving your country was a good and noble thing to do. And that was true in 1961 when he made that speech. It was true in 1963 when he died. And it is true in 2013. And I hope it continues to be true for a very, very long time.
And we can go on and on, back and forth, around and around about the reasons why that perception doesn't exist today. But it strikes me that that's not really constructive. The constructive mm-hmm. discussion is, how do we get that back? Because
right.
as many times as we talk about the retirement wave and all of that, many of the people who are leaving government now after serving a noble career of however many years heard those words and said, I want that. I want to be a part of that. And those are the folks that we're losing now. And I wonder where we start, do you think, to bring that back, to get people to look at service in the federal government in that way again?
Well, I get to spend every day working with folks in government, and every day I'm amazed and impressed by how committed they are, how service-oriented they are, but how frustrated they are by the organizations that surround them, and of which they are a part sometimes. And getting the structure to support the noble cause that people are working to endeavor is the biggest challenge in my mind. How many times you see good people leaving government because of their inability to affect change, and it's not them, it's the size and scope and process that burdens them. So I would like to think it would be as simple as getting more good people in government, but mm-hmm. it's not the problem. There are plenty of good people in government. It's the structure that surrounds them and that holds them back, and the process and politics that hold them back, I think, that is the real problem.
This is exactly the kind of thing that you write about regularly on your Chief HRO blog, and that's
correct.
ChiefHRO.com,
that's
is that
correct.
Right? And we'll have put a link up to that later at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth2, because I think what you write there is constructive and supportive of these kinds of issues and the people who deal with them on an ongoing basis. But where do we start? And who has to start it, I guess? Because I talk to people all the time at the agencies who are trying. It seems to me there's 535 people in particular that would be terrific starters for getting some of these things straightened up.
I agree with you completely. Those 535 members of Congress in the House and the Senate need to start. You know, we learned a very important lesson after the war in Vietnam. A lot of people hated that war, and they hated the men and women who fought it. And we learned after that regardless of how you feel about the conflicts this country gets involved in, you don't take out that frustration on those troops. You don't hate the warrior. And I think if you don't like what the government does, it's fine to criticize the policy. It's fine to work to change the policy. It's not fine to attack the men and women in government who don't make those decisions, who don't pass the laws. If you want to criticize public policy, criticize the policy, not the people. And I would be very happy if our Congress would start learning that lesson themselves. And then I would love to see people taking the time to appreciate what public servants do every day all over this country and all over the world. And I think we could make a difference. We changed the attitude about the military in an enormous way. Over really just a short few years. And we learned an important lesson. I'd like to see us learn the same lesson with the federal workforce.
So in that spirit, I will give you a pass then on choosing a non-news story as your most important federal news story of the week. Remarks by President Kennedy, his State of the Union address in 1961, as we observe the 50th anniversary of his assassination in Dallas. That's Jeff Neal's choice on this week's Federal News Countdown for number one. It's great to see you as always, my friend. And Tim Hex, you also. Thanks. My friend, thank you for being on the countdown this week. All of our stories archived as always at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon.